I saw a quote that says, adulting is too hard. Let's play something else. If you are a young adult, if you have a young adult, or if your children will soon be young adults, you can appreciate that becoming a grown-up is no easy task. If your child happens to struggle with dyslexia, ADHD, or other learning differences, adulting on their part and letting go on your part just got harder. Today, we have a wonderful, empathetic speaker, author, and mentor who gets where you're coming from. You're going to get a peek into the world of today's young adult, learn about parenting young adults with learning or attention challenges, and learn how over-parenting can impede executive function and what to do instead. This is LD Expert Live. Welcome to LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning differences, dyslexia, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers and author of At Wit's End, A Parent's Guide to Ending the Struggle, Tears, and Turmoil of Learning Disabilities. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens struggle in school and what can be done to change that permanently. To get a free copy, go to parentsatwitsend.com. Our guest today is Julie Lithcott-Hames. Julie believes in humans and is deeply interested in what gets in our way. Her work encompasses writing, speaking, mentoring, and activism. She is the New York Times best-selling author of the Anti-Helicopter Parenting Manifesto, How to Raise an Adult, which gave rise to a popular TED Talk. Her second book is the critically acclaimed and award-winning prose poetry memoir, Real American, which illustrates her experience as a Black and biracial person in white spaces. A third book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult, has been called a groundbreakingly frank guide to adulthood. Julie is a former corporate lawyer and Stanford dean, and she holds a BA from Stanford, a JD from Harvard, and an MFA in writing from California College of the Arts. She currently serves on the boards of Common Sense Media and the Black Women's Health Imperative, and on the advisory board of LeanIn.org and Parents Magazine. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her partner of over 30 years and their itinerant young adults and her mother. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Julie. It's so great to have you.
It's great to be here with you and your team. You're doing me quite an honor by inviting me to be on your show. Really, really appreciate it and grateful to those who've chosen to listen in today and participate in the conversation.
Well, we're so happy to have you. Before we jump into our discussion today, I want to say congratulations to you. I understand you just started a book launch for your new book, Your Turn, How to Be an Adult.
Thank you. The book, it's hard to launch a book during a pandemic. It's been out for about 6 months, and I'm always delighted to hear from people on social media that they've got a copy, that they're listening to it, or they're holding it in their hands, and that it's making them feel supported on their journey to live a meaningful, rewarding life. So super excited to have this book out in the world. And my hope is that it'll find the readers who need it.
Well, you know, I just feel so fortunate that you were able to join us because I know you're going to get crazy busy now. In fact, before the show, you were saying you've already virtually been in England and New York and
this morning.
So super busy. So tell us a little bit more about your book.
Yeah. So Your Turn, How to Be an Adult is my effort to say to all humans, I care about you. I've got you. It is scary to adult. It is bewildering. There's this wide open landscape of possibility, and you can often feel worried about where to start or how to start. You might be inundated with messages about what you should do, yet there's a piece of you wondering what you could do. You wonder if you have the skills you need, whether it's practical things or more around your interior life, your emotions, your ability to cope with setbacks or try and persist when things are hard. All of that is covered in this book. And it's really just my compassionate offering to all humans that, like, yep, it's hard. Yep, I get it. And I believe in you and I'm here for you. I'm rooting for you to live your one wild and precious life, to quote the late poet Mary Oliver. So this book is about beckoning you to make the choices in work, in school, in relationships, to make the choices that are really consistent with what your innermost self, your soul, your spirit wants this life to be.
Wow. I love your one wild and precious life, man. That's a great quote. You know, when I was growing up, the picture of being an adult was finish college, get a job, get married, have kids. Today's picture seems like it's a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. The traditional definition assumed everybody was straight, and it assumed that a woman went from being the property of her dad to being the property of her husband. And thankfully, those norms have gone by the wayside. We have so much more choice now in this 21st century about, you know, what to do for our education beyond high school and with whom to be in relationship and what kind of jobs and where we might do those jobs. There's tremendous freedom and flexibility now, which I think contributes to the stress around, well, what is the right path? My answer, there is no right path. It's what's the right next step for you right now. But we, I think when there was a lockstep plan and a set of expectations about a narrow path in life, it might have felt easier to walk that path because there was only that one path. So now we have this wide open landscape. Everything is possible. And there are new constraints that make not everything possible, like the macroeconomic reality that for a young adult today who's taken on student loans, if they've gone to college or maybe hasn't got student loans, but nevertheless is in a part of the country where the rent has outpaced income and wages, they got to live at home. And people, their grandpa might say, why are you living at home? In my day, we moved, like, well, grandpa, macroeconomically, rent is more than income. Okay, so how am I supposed to make that work? So it's not about where you live. It's not about with whom you live. It's, are you behaving as an adult wherever you are? That's about knowing, you wake up knowing, you know what? I'm responsible for myself. That's the basic definition of child versus adult. In childhood, you are more or less the responsibility of somebody else, assuming your parents can provide food and shelter and safety and comfort and all of that, which I know is not something all of us have. And so you might have to grow up sooner if you have a tougher childhood. In childhood, typically you are someone else's responsibility. In adulthood, typically you are more or less responsible for yourself, which doesn't mean you have to go it alone, but it does mean, you know, it's on me. I got to take care of my body, my bills, my business, my belongings. You know, you can ask for help, but you've also got to kind of enter every day knowing I can, I will, and I can cope. I mean, we're talking about agency, the knowledge in the psyche that I am capable. No matter what our limitations and challenges and diagnoses may be, we all hunger to still do as much as we can and not to be overly helped or handled. So we need that agency, I can, and that resilience, which is, I know I can cope. And we get resilience by knowing we've coped with stuff in the past. Now we can cope with stuff again. And so these are the basic building blocks that will lead to a successful adulthood. This doesn't speak to how to make choices about what to do with your life, for work, for school, where to be in relationship. But these are the fundamental things we want our children to possess when they leave our homes: agency, resilience, and I would add good character, which is all about how they interact with other humans.
Great. I was just going to ask you to repeat those again, so I'm glad you did that. So you mentioned something about diagnoses. Let's talk about students who have learning or attention challenges. Is the process of being an adult different for a young person, say, with ADHD or learning differences?
First of all, I have a lot of compassion for humans with learning differences or really any challenges. I mean, there's this beautiful book, Normal Sucks, by Jonathan Mooney, where he really makes the point that normal is an outdated term. We most of us deal with something that makes us a little different from some perceived norm. And I'm certainly one of those people. I'm old enough. I'm 53. In my generation, we typically weren't given the opportunity to be diagnosed for our challenges. And I think I am somebody who struggles with attention issues, although I don't have a diagnosis. One of my kids has a diagnosis and allows me to talk about it. My son Sawyer has a diagnosis of ADHD, dysgraphia, and anxiety. And so I, as a parent, have a lot of awareness and empathy, certainly for anybody who's traveling this path. And I think I have traveled this path and I'm traveling this path myself without any formal diagnosis. So first thing I wanted to offer in response to your question is compassion, and to indicate that I'm doing my best to not just be compassionate, but understand. The second thing I'll say is, yeah, it's different. Adulting, if I've already said, it's about being more or less responsible for yourself. Well, if you have an executive function that isn't as fully developed as it'll one day be, if you are struggling with your attention, if you have other challenges, it might mean that kind of the things that other people think are basic are harder for you. You're not capable of them yet. You are becoming that person who will be more capable, and you're going to need a little bit more time and some resources and supports around becoming that person. I think what's clear to me is, often we parents think, oh, my kid doesn't have the executive function, so I need to basically do it for them. And that's a big red flag. And I've been there, believe me. But what happens is we then think, my kid can't, so I'd better do it for them, which means we're depriving them of the very experiences along the way that would actually help them develop more of that capability and that knowledge that they're capable. So as parents, we have to be more patient. We have to parent for the longer term of that kid is going to get to where they need to get by walking the path of life. I'm sorry, I'm struggling with where my hands need to be because the video is reversed. By walking the path of life, a little bit more deliberately. They can't take things for granted that kids who lack those diagnoses can, but they'll get there. And we need to always remember, we want them to be as capable as they can be living with this diagnosis, rather than us, the parent, trying to just handle it all for them because of the diagnosis.
And that is huge. You know, if we want our kids to get to the point that they are responsible for themselves, you know, it may take a little bit longer, but, you know, we have to give them opportunities to do that and kind of be the guide, as opposed to being the person doing the work. And I love what you said. They're not there yet. They're getting there. They're on their way.
Yeah.
So in your book, you tell your story about yourself as a young adult, probably with undiagnosed ADHD. Would you share that?
Which story? I'm not sure which one you're referring to.
You were telling me a story of when you went off to college. And I know, you know, a lot of our students, you know, they are looking towards or just going off to college. And what was that like for you?
Yeah. So let me open by saying, this book, which is very much a thick self-help book that you can listen to or you can hold in your hands, it's filled with stories. There are a lot of very practical lists on the various things, from managing money to looking after your mental health and wellness and and bodily wellness and lists for everything, but there are also a lot of stories because some humans learn from story and some humans learn from lists. And I'm trying to be available to all learners in this book. I'm also trying to tell stories that come out of different communities. So I'm referencing a person who's struggling with anxiety and depression, and I'm referencing someone who's dealing with bipolar, and I'm referencing the presence of ADHD and social anxiety as I'm trying to give advice to everybody about how to live your best life. So I've tried to write a book that is very inclusive, that imagines all readers. As a Black and biracial person, I've grown up not being imagined by authors. They tend not to speak, you know, I've been otherized on the page. I know what that's like. And I'm really trying to be very inclusive with this book. So my story in college was one at the outset of struggle. I was at a very elite place. I had done very well in high school and I got admitted to this elite place, Stanford University. And I began to struggle. My high school wasn't very rigorous. It had no AP classes as an example of the lack of rigor. And so I got to this elite place as competing with kids who'd had so much more by way of opportunity in high school. And I began to struggle in every class. My midterms came back with poor marks. There were red writings all over my papers. And I was so ashamed that I was struggling. I didn't ask for help. I couldn't, when I got a paper back, you know, with all of this red scribbled all over it, you know, I'm trying to find a piece of paper so to demonstrate it visually, like, here I am, like, you know, I've gotten this paper and it's like, oh my gosh, red comments everywhere. And I just couldn't bring myself to say to the professor, like, I'm the person that you wrote all of this to. And I got the C's and the D's on my midterms. I just was ashamed. And so I didn't seek out tutoring, office hours with faculty, a meeting with the teaching assistant, academic advising. I didn't ask a friend. These are five different things a human can do when they're struggling. But I was so ashamed to be the person who is struggling. I couldn't bring myself to ask for help. So inevitably, the terrible grades at the end of the quarter came. A B, which I think was a mercy B. I probably deserved worse. A C and a D. I had a 2.0 GPA, 1/10 of a point above academic probation. And my parents called me and they said, you know, this was in the era when you got your grades in the mail. And so I opened my grades. And then in January, my parents in February on the phone from 2,000 miles away in Wisconsin, I was in California at Stanford. They said, how did it go first quarter, baby? And I had been holding it all in, bottling it up, and I began to cry. And to their immense credit, they told me they loved me, that they believed in me. And they said, why don't you go to that academic advising office we heard so much about when we visited? So off I went. And they sat me down. I had an appointment and they asked me questions. What are you taking? Why are you taking those things? How do you study? How do you take lecture notes? How do you do your reading? How do you take notes on the reading? I didn't have answers to most of those questions because my own study habits, what had been required in high school, was not all of that. So they said, kid, you've got what it takes intellectually to thrive here, but your study skills need some work and your time management needs some work. And we've got workshops that you can participate in, which we highly recommend. You won't be the only person there. We offer this. And in retrospect, I can see that they, you know, they were almost telling me, like, you have some attention issues and you have some executive function issues. We didn't use that language in 1985 when I got to college. But I will tell you, Jill, by the time I got to law school, so I did manage to, you know, develop better habits and take classes I loved and turn things around. And I'm now off at law school and I show up at my law school and I say, hello, law school. I would like a seat down front, please, because that's how I can really pay attention. And could I also have a dedicated little space in the library? I know you only give them to the third year students, but if there's any way there's an extra one, I would love one because it really helps me concentrate if I'm not out at a big table. And they said, you need to see disability resources for that. And I was like, what are you talking about? Right. I did not know I had a disability. No one had ever said I had a disability. I had just figured out by the time I was 24, 23, what I needed in place in order to be successful. And I was rejected because I didn't have documented anything that would justify any of my requests being granted. So, wow, I've just, for the first time, I think really made that connection thanks to your asking me to share this story. Jill, thank you.
You know, thank you for sharing your stories. I mean, there's so many pieces in there that I know our parents and young adults will relate to. We have so many students at the Learning Center who are very bright. And when you have a very bright child, sometimes it's hard to see the challenges. And it's hard for the school to see the challenges and want, you know, then understand that some accommodations may be helpful. With your son,
yeah,
did you run into that kind of an issue for him?
So Sawyer is 22. And as I think I've already mentioned, he does give me permission to talk about this. I'm saying that because for any parent listening, we have to, whether it's photographs on Instagram of their cute little bodies or conversations about their health, wellness, diagnoses, situations, we have to be respectful that this isn't our little dog we can just show everybody. Like, they're a human and they deserve privacy around their circumstances. So I'm very deliberately saying, my son gives me permission to say what I'm about to say to you. He was diagnosed with anxiety, a little bit of anxiety and a whole lot of ADHD and dysgraphia in the fourth grade. And we did a little bit of leaning in and learning about and getting him some resources and supports, but he was so very bright and so very capable that these issues didn't really seem to be undermining his performance. And that's what we were focused on, his performance. And so, you know, he had some accommodations in middle school. We a few times signed off that he had worked really long and hard on this, but couldn't get it all done. And when it, you know, it got to high school, they said, we can't give him accommodations because he gets all A's. And I just didn't even know what to do with that information. I'm this highly educated person, a dean at this point at Stanford University, right up the road. And I didn't really know how to advocate for my kid. I didn't really understand. I just kept focusing on how bright he was. And I'm telling you this, I'm not suggesting anybody should do what I did. I'm telling you how I learned the hard way that these challenges my son faces are, they matter. Mm-hmm. They're real. They are important. And it wasn't until he got to college, a very rigorous small liberal arts college, where his grades went from A's and B's to B's and C's to C's and D's to D's and F's at the end of sophomore year. And he decided, I better take a year off and kind of figure stuff out. And we were like, okay, our kid is taking a year off school. He's clearly had this downward spiral. What are we going to do? So my husband and I bought all the books, air quotes. We bought some books by Ned Halliwell, who had been recommended to us as somebody who writes in the ADD space. And we flagged up the books. We, you know, post-it notes. And my husband was reading them. I was reading them. We're kind of round robin reading these books as our son is about to come home to take a year off from college. And the books were stacked in his dad's office, in my husband's office, near the printer. And Sawyer went into the office to get something off the printer within days of coming home. And he came out of his dad's office and he said, Mom, I saw the books in dad's office. And I was like, oh no, we should have hidden the books. Like, he shouldn't know that we're reading up on him. And I was worried that he was going to be mad. So I was then stunned when he smiled and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Mom, thanks for taking an interest in understanding who I am. And it just made me cry because I said, Sawyer, I'm so sorry. I haven't always taken that interest. I thought I was taking that interest. I thought I knew who you were. I thought I was loving you and every single dimension that you are, but Dad and I have come to realize, and you can bet I brought Dad into that too. It wasn't just going to be me, right? Dad and I have come to appreciate that we thought we understood these diagnoses, but we didn't. And we are now deeply invested in being the parents who know what you need and deserve, who show up for you in ways that are helpful, who do our work to try to repattern what the patterns may have been in our family so that we can support you in thriving and in loving you as you are. And that was a huge turning point for us. That would have been the fall, the summer of 2019. And a lot more stuff would come after that, but that's the story of my aha and finally accepting my son's diagnoses as a valid and real component of who this young person is.
That is such great insight. And I do appreciate you and Sawyer being willing to share that. We often see this kind of challenge with students with ADHD or dyslexia. They're brilliant and talented, and they may have high emotional intelligence. So they have all kinds of tools for covering their struggles and seeming like they're okay when they're really not. And it takes its toll in stress and anxiety and self-esteem, and then eventually catches up to them. So, you know, I just really appreciate you sharing that so that we can all understand our kids better.
Yeah. And may I say, Jill, you know, so this new book, Your Turn, is one in which I tell that story about Sawyer, about me coming to appreciate what Sawyer's challenges are, some of them. And I have it in the chapter on self-care, which is take good care of yourself. And I say, you know, you may not have been seen in some of the identities you carry or around some of the conditions or situations you may struggle with. And I say, I tell the story about Sawyer. And then I say, if you need somebody to read this page, flag it. You know, I'm trying to picture the reader who will read this and say, my parents need to see what Julie has just admitted to in terms of her own parenting. Because I think there's nothing more credible than a so-called authority figure who's written books saying, you know what? I struggle too. I'm doing my work. You know, I'm on the journey of learning still too. And that's the kind of vulnerability I try to bring to my work. So that I think it translates into credibility, I hope, certainly to readers feeling not judged, but seen and supported on this journey. That's my work.
Absolutely. And I love that you say for them to feel seen, because so often, you know, there's this big emphasis on performance and all of the things that we do, and we need to. And our kids may be able to do that. They may be able to find a way to do it, but we need to see the whole picture and see them. So I really appreciate that.
I love that you're resonating with that. And Sawyer has gravitated toward being a summer camp counselor for a number of years now. He gets a tremendous amount of joy from it. And he's told he's good at it, which is amazing. And there was a little kid this summer. You know, so first it didn't have camp last summer because of COVID. Now it's sort of a masked camp. And a little kid who is maybe 7 in his group said on day one to Sawyer, I just want you to know I might have trouble paying attention because I have ADD. And Sawyer just knelt down and looked at this kid and said, I got you. Me too. You know, and he comes home and tells us that story. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, first of all, that little 7-year-old knowing, like, being raised with tell people, right, being told to advocate for himself, which he did. And then he was met with my 22-year-old who was like, yep, I see you, kid. I get it. Me too. Like, whoa, that is so beautiful.
It is. This is LD Expert Live. I'm Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers. And my guest today is author and speaker Julie Lithcott-Hames. We're talking about growing kids into adulthood. So, Julie, let's talk a little bit more about the idea of over-parenting. Executive function is a huge concern for parents today, especially after this year of online schooling. I know you have some strong opinions and some great advice for parents about what it takes to grow independent kids and young adults. And I know you've kind of seeded that through, you know, the whole broadcast, but just let's talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. So I'm actually opening my first book, How to Raise an Adult, which is on the harm of overparenting, because there are studies that are linking an over-involved parenting style with lower rates of executive function and also with more anxiety and depression. And here's my understanding. I'm not a psychologist. I have read studies done by psychologists. And here is essentially the why around executive function. Executive function develops by trying some things and getting some feedback that, oh, that didn't work, and then trying again. It is the living of life that develops the ability to live life, okay? So when the system seems to expect our five-year-old or our fourth grader or our 10th grader or whomever to be at this level and get these things done, and their executive function isn't yet there, and if we've stepped in for them at five and we've stepped in for them at eight and at 10 and 12, we've may have deprived them of the very experiences that would make them more competent by the time they get to this more grown place. So we have to take a deep breath and say, well, my kid's still working on that, and we're just going to give it time. It undermines our kids' confidence as well. In addition to depriving them of the trial and error that they'd experience if we step back a little bit, we're also really harmfully sending the message, you can't be successful as you are as a kindergartner, so I have to do your work, or as a fourth grader or an eighth grader or what have you. So it's this very damaging psychological message when we step in and do for them. So what I talk about is a four-step method for teaching any kid any skill, and how long the four steps take and is all a function of what's the skill, who's the kid, what's their diagnosis, okay? But skills like you got to learn to tie your own shoes. You got to learn to cross the street. You got to learn to use a knife and fork. You got to learn to, these are the basics, right? But I'm throwing them out because in modern parenting, we're tying their shoes too long. We're cutting their food too long. We're holding them or holding them by the hand too long. And it feels and is loving. We're trying to help, but we have totally forgotten that our job is to prepare for our own death. Our own demise will one day come. And we don't want then for our kid to discover, oh, I can't do anything because my parents always did everything for me. Like any mammal parent, we are preparing our offspring to be able to thrive without us, and every step of childhood is an opportunity. And I want to remind you of the steps you allowed them to take on their own when they were learning to walk. You made sure that the living room or whatever room they were in, the family room, the hallway, didn't have any sharp objects if they fell, right? Your job was to make sure the environment they're in will not harm them. But then you stood back and you let them fall. You let them fall. Okay. You didn't get embarrassed. Oh, my kid isn't walking yet. You didn't overparent. You didn't put your hand around their tiny little body and kind of hold them up as they tried to walk and like, clap, look, we walked, because you knew that ain't walking. Same with the bicycle. You want to run along holding on, but you know they won't develop balance if I'm constantly holding, okay? Let these visual metaphors of learning to walk and falling and getting back up and falling and getting back up, which is the only way they develop balance, core strength, and leg strength. Let that visual of learning to walk, let the visual of learning to ride a bike be your visual metaphor for every single skill they're supposed to learn, okay? First, you do it for them. You're carrying them. They're not walking. Then you do it with them. You're holding them by the hand, okay? Then you're watching them do it. They're now taking their steps themselves, but you're still there in case they start to really pick up the pace and walk, you know, out the door. And then finally, they can walk places on their own without you. This four-step method applies to everything they need to learn. And if you want the details on it, including a cute little cartoon describing it, it's on my website, julielithcotthames.com. Click on how to raise an adult and you'll get it.
Those are great steps, you know, and it applies to every piece of learning pretty much. You know, the brain really does learn through trial and error. As we work with students at the learning centers, we have to work at a challenging enough level that they're going to make errors. That's the only way that the brain gets the signal that something isn't quite right and it needs to change. The other day, I was working with a student who's about 10. He's dyslexic and spelling is really hard for him. So we were working on him being able to take a mental picture of the words in order to spell them. And I could tell that he wasn't really getting a picture. And it would be tempting to say, oh, I'll just let him look at the cue a little bit longer, or I'll use shorter words so that he can do it easily. But instead, we talked about what we were trying to get his brain to do. And we kept, you know, trying different ways to go after it. And it was amazing to watch him learn. He kept saying, no, wait, don't tell me. Right. And I see him mentally working at it and correcting himself and talking himself through. And then he'd get it or partially get it. And the more we did, the more solid the process got. So even though he's not there yet totally, letting him work it out without me jumping in constantly to modify or help or tell him was so much more rewarding for both of us. He could see that he was starting to get it on his own, and he was so happy about it. And the next time we do it, the activity will be quicker and easier. That's how learning happens.
Jill, that's such a beautiful story. And, you know, the examples I gave around cutting food and learning to walk, they are behavioral, but it definitely translates right into the learning modality. Another example that comes to mind is how we rescue our kids at school. I mean, what really is coming to mind is why is life so busy and paced in such a way that we are impatient around our own kids' learning process? The system seems to expect kids to be so much farther along than my kid is. Therefore, I've got to bring my kid along instead of being patient and letting my kid go through the steps, as you've just beautifully articulated with this kid, that they need in order for them to get themselves to this place of accomplishment and arrival. Reminding kids and rescuing kids at school is another example of where parents say, like, you didn't bring your homework, I will drop everything and drive it to you. It feels very loving. If there's something really important due and they've left it at home, it is very loving to deliver it. But as a matter of routine, the way the brain learns, I got to remember my backpack, is by experiencing the discomfort of, I didn't have my backpack and my teacher, you know, was unhappy with me. That consequence can help the brain learn, okay, I don't want that to happen again. And at home, we can say, all right, that must not have felt very good. Let's figure out what we could do, what we could have in place at home as a matter of a ritual, a routine, a checklist, something so that you can have greater confidence that you'll be able to get your backpack to school. And it may not happen on the second try or the third, but it might happen on the fourth. This goes for waking themselves up. They should be waking themselves up, not having parents wake them up. We have parents waking college students up now because they never have let their kid face the consequences of not waking up at home. And so they've helped them all the way to this point, gotten them to college, and like, I have to wake them up now, you know, because I'm paying all this money. It's like, well, you were supposed to teach that skill a long time ago.
Yeah. This is LD Expert Live. Today, we're talking to Julie Lithcott-Hames about how to avoid the trap of overparenting and how to prepare your kids for success as an adult. This is LD Expert Live. I'm Jill Stoll, here with Julie Lithcott-Hames. Julie, thank you for being here with us today and being so vulnerable and giving us so much of your expertise and advice, truly. I wish you the very best on your book launch. Your Turn, How to Be an Adult, is a must read for young adults and a wonderful glimpse for parents into their young adults' world. Julie, what would you like to leave our audience with today?
You know, I've shared a few of my own stories to try to demonstrate to you that I'm not here as an expert judging you, but I'm a mom, I'm a parent, I'm a human on my own journey, doing my best, as I know we all are. So I want to offer you is kindness, compassion. We all love our kids fiercely. We're trying to do right by them. And there's a lot about life that's bewildering, and there's a lot that's happening with our kids that's bewildering. And being in community with one another about our struggles is so important. Seeking out great resources like STOL, LD Expert Live, this is all helping us on our journey. We all want to be seen and loved and cherished as we are. And when we have kids with a diagnosis, that can be a hurdle for us. So I encourage you, if you are still fighting the diagnosis or fighting the fact that, you know, they're not, particularly if you're comparing one kid to the other, like this one's great, but this one's got, see if, you know, it may be worthwhile an investment in some therapy for yourself. We have been in family therapy around the ways we've patterned things in this house of mine with my kid, Sawyer, and family therapy now that he's 22. Has been so illuminating because we've gotten able to see how we have kind of very protectively managed and handled, which undermines his ability. So look, I'm trying to offer this with a 22-year-old to anyone who's got younger kids, because maybe you can do some fine tuning or some major overhauling in your own patterns with your kid sooner than I did. I think that's why I'm here, to try to offer help and insight to those coming up on the path behind me in terms of the age of your kids in comparison to mine.
Thank you, Julie. Wow. Thank you for the compassion that you're putting out there in the world. I love that. Thank you for being with us today. At STOL Learning Centers, we work with children and adults doing targeted brain training to permanently eliminate struggles associated with dyslexia, auditory processing, and other learning differences, so that students can become independent learners and thrive in school. If you would like a free consultation for yourself or your child, give us a call or visit our website at stolcenter.com.